This is episode 352, dated Friday, March 22nd, 2024.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
And hello again, everybody. Welcome to In Perspective. My name is Bob Branco, and this is episode 352. Dated Friday, March 22nd, 2024. Before we continue, let me introduce our co-host and good friend, Peter O'Toole. Peter, what's going on? How you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's pouring rain here in Coos Bay, which I suspect is quite different from the way it was on Palm Sunday in Jerusalem. But we're doing fine here. We're sort of hoping that spring will come sometime, not next week. It's supposed to rain all next week, but the following week. After Easter.
Well, I think we're going to be in worse shape than that, Peter. In northern New England tomorrow, they are predicting a snowstorm.
I saw that. Not in Boston, but...
No, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, mostly.
No, I saw that. That's very impressive.
That's what they're saying. Anyhow, let me offer some thanks to people who make it possible for our show to be made available. We start out with Raymond Gay, our producer. Thank you for what you do. Tom and Lynn from Rosie's Place Chatline, thank you for posting our shows. Our media outlets, I want to thank all of you for airing us when you do. It's much appreciated. Also to Jacqueline Sylvia of JS Web Solutions. She puts our shows up on my website. All you have to do is go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcasts. Click on those. And you will see most of our archived programs dating back several years, from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie. And Bob, before I turn it back over to you, I want to give a shout out to my mom, who's 91 years old, who listens religiously to our podcast and often makes comments. So as we say on the show, merci, Nancy.
I've seen some of her comments. And Nancy, I want to thank you so much for your continued support. We appreciate it. And speaking of support, let me offer another hello to a faithful listener, Henry Ashen of Lowell, Massachusetts. Thank you very much for listening. We appreciate it. We're bringing back a former guest. She's been on our show before, Elizabeth Sammons. She's an author. And one of the reasons that we brought her back, amongst many, is because she's introducing us, well, she's introducing me, to this concept because I hadn't heard about it before until she mentioned it. And Elizabeth, correct me if I'm saying this wrong, disability welcoming in arts. And you can explain what that is. First of all, welcome.
Thank you. And it's really nice to hear your voice, Bob, and you, Peter. And I add my thanks to everyone who makes this show possible. And, you know, since I wrote that to you, I decided I was going to make it a little simpler. The name of my consulting and what I'm calling it now is AWE, which stands for Arts Welcoming Everyone.
That sounds easier to say.
Yes.
All for short. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm in awe of that, Elizabeth. I really am. No pun intended.
Yeah.
Actually, the pun was intended, but my intentions were good. So tell us about AWE.
Yes. Well, historically, people who have disabilities, and I would even say particularly people who have visual disabilities, have been some of the least served or provided for guests when they come to museums or to other historic places. Because our assumption is that people coming to those places are able to see, able to walk, able to hear, and other things. And so the administrators have never deliberately excluded groups of people with disability, but they historically simply have not thought about them very much. And Arts Welcoming Everyone is trying to gently, but firmly, and with very concrete examples and advice, help museums and other arts places to consider what it takes to help guests with any type of disability have an easier visit, a more friendly visit, and a more informed visit when they come to those places.
So this is a consulting business that you set up. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I'd like to tell you how it began, because it's such a funny story. In my last interview, which was about 2 years ago, talking about my novel, I think I mentioned that I had, you know, early resigned, but, you know, I was doing creative writing and different things, which is true. And related to my creative writing, I did some artist talks in museums and bookstores and libraries. And always when I saw something that worked well for people with disabilities, I would say it. But unfortunately, I saw things that didn't work well. And I also would respectfully, but very clearly talk about those or write about those to the administration. And when I did that, I always tried to make some suggestions. So not just saying, oh, well, this is bad, you guys obviously didn't think about it, but saying, understanding that you want to include as many people as you can, this presents a barrier because da 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 da. However, if we take this example of another place like yours, this is what they did, and it really worked out well. And I was not looking for any kind of consulting or anything beyond just helping them. And in a 4-month period, I had 3 museums and an individual artist who is now artist in residence at Princeton. I knew her when she was a literally almost poor starving artist, who all came to me and just said, we would like to know more and we would like to make our places more welcoming to people with disabilities. Would you consult with us and help us? And when 4 different, very similar questions from people who none of them knew each other came to me in 3 months, I thought, you know, there might be something to this story, and I think I should begin to do this in a more serious way. So that's how it began.
And so what kind of consulting do you do? How does your business work?
Well, every museum or exhibit or historical place is different. So there is no, for sure, there is no one size fits all answer. And I think being a creative artist and loving the art as much as I do has helped me to really think of some creative expressions that other people may have never even tried. For example, just one tiny example. One museum was thinking about how to possibly make a Torah scroll accessible. The scroll was leather. The scroll had ink on it. You know, it was not something that anyone could touch. And I said, what if you made a t-shirt with raised Hebrew reproduction of what's on the scroll, that people can take this long length of material and feel the raised things? Well, they had never thought about that, and they thought it was a great idea. So it takes creativity. The other thing that I was asked to do in one museum, and I didn't like the idea initially because I have very broad experience with many, many different disabilities, not just blindness. But looking back, I realized how wise it was, and now I try every chance I can to do this, is to invite others of different disabilities who are interested in the arts or who are artists themselves. So, for example, maybe a deaf artist, someone with intellectual disabilities or mental health issues, someone with mobility impairments, to join in a tour of the museum and to pool our comments, combine those comments, and submit that as a report of not do all and end all. This is a complete and utter evaluation of your museum, but here are reactions from people who care about the arts, people who have different disabilities, and whose combined perspectives can really give you great ideas, many of which don't even cost any money, to be able to incorporate into your museum and make it more welcoming.
So you do these tours, you bring in people with other disabilities to help you with your work, which I think makes a whole lot of sense, makes it more cross-disability focused. Do you help with the implementation? And then you write a report. Do you help with the implementation of these suggestions?
You know, because my consulting only began in 2022, any kind of an institution is a very large and often slow-moving entity. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All of the places that I have worked with know that I am available and very open to helping them continue. It just has not at this point gotten to that point beyond, you know, they have done many things, but they haven't asked me for additional help with things that they need. But I hope they will.
Yeah, no. So I talk more about some of the things you've noticed. I know every museum is different, and they're different worlds sometimes. But
right,
talk about sort of what you're noticing in general, mm-hmm. if you can, about what's working well, and then what it may not be working quite as well.
Well, one thing that's working well is it's actually surprising how many museums and historical places have thought about disability communities. One of them even had an electric charger for a wheelchair, but it wasn't advertised anywhere, not on their website, not at the front desk, and the staff had not been trained to let people know about it. So one commonality in many of the places I've worked in is saying, strut your stuff, let people know what you have, let them know on the website, and make sure your front desk people, they don't need to say, oh, I see you have a wheelchair, poor thing. Well, if it runs out of juice, we have this. But if they could say, so you know, if there's any situation where you would need a charge, we have it available here. Or the same if someone came in who's visually impaired. Some of them have even Braille or audio equipment or brochures. And if they simply say, is there anything we can do to make your visit more fun? Or say,
sort of like a universal design environment.
Yes. And making sure that they know that things are available, that makes a huge, huge difference.
But it's not just what to say, but as you say, how to say it. Mm-hmm. That's really important, isn't it?
It's very important. Yes, it is very important. And so just making a question, is there anything we could offer that would make it, you know, a more pleasant visit for you? It's a completely non-threatening question. And it's not saying, it's obvious that you're da-da-da-da-da.
But you're reaching up.
We're reaching out, welcoming.
You're making a general offer to a general population,
yeah,
who has various issues, but we're trying to make it as general as possible. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I can't tell many times to Bob, I'm sure we've all experienced this. You know, people mean well, but they say things in such a way that they turn me off. You know.
Oh yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
They're well intentioned, but I understand what you mean, Peter.
Yeah,
no.
Well, they're well intentioned. Yeah.
Something I have not seen museums doing, and right. I'm hoping that they will, and I'm strongly encouraging them, is to say, once you've put some of these things in practice, you could put $1 million into this, but if people don't know about it or don't come, then you really haven't spent the money well. It really needs to be made known to the disability community that these are the things you're doing. So reach out. And I also have said, you know, to visitors who have disability, you need to reach out to your community too, because that's what needs to happen on the other side.
Elizabeth, I can't help but share this story. This was a long time ago. I don't know if you work with national parks. It doesn't strike me as something you might work with, but there was back in the early 1970s, there was a Braille trail that was set up where you could hold on to the rope with your hand and follow the rope, and it took you over a boardwalk, and there were Braille things that you could read. It was really cool back in 1971 or whatever year it was. And so my mom and I and my sister were taking the walk, and I can't remember precisely what it said, but the Braille said, if you reach out to your right, you will see the rough bark of an oak tree or something. And mom said, no, you will not. What you will see is poison ivy. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, I didn't touch it. But as soon as mom got back to the house, she called to the national parks, to try to get the problem straightened out. And, the park, well, we can't mess with nature. We can't do any of this stuff. It's not possible. And mom decided that the best way to approach this, if I remember the story correctly, was to call the local news channel.
Mm-hmm.
And threatened to. I can't remember if she actually called them or not. But sure enough, the next time we went for that walk, the poison ivy was gone.
That's a great story. And I would like to use that maybe in some future thought something they do much more in Europe than they do in the United States is tactile markings on the floor or on the sidewalk that are very easy to follow for people who have either soft-soled shoes or white canes. And in a couple of museums, what I've seen, and I think it's wonderful, is where you're supposed to stop and, you know, maybe turn on your audio description or face something, they have a little branch off with sort of two footprints. So you're actually facing directly where they want you to face, or you know there's a braille sign there or a picture or something there. And it's a very simple thing, but it's something I wish that we implemented more in the USA.
And if we're
I've been on some braille trails also. I've been on braille trails, so I can relate to Peter's story, not the poison ivy story, but the concept of a braille trail. They are set up that way. And they're very informative if they're done right.
Yeah.
The one thing I'd say about those domes, I think that you're talking about, is they have to be wide enough because I'm running into a problem here. This is nothing with the arts. That dome is too short. My guide dog and I often step over it. We don't feel it. Mm-hmm. And we are in danger of getting run over by a car. Now, of course, the dogs are trained to do that, but you have to know the thing is there in the first place before you can train the dog to. Anyway, you talked about some of the similarities between the museums you're working with. Mm-hmm. Talk about some of the unique, you talked about the Jewish scroll, the Torah, which I thought was mm-hmm. fascinating. What other sort of unique things have you recommended or seen that might be, you know, a little different?
Well, this isn't unique, but some museums have said, look, we have this much money. We can either do this or do this or do this, but we can't do all three. And I have always said to them, generally, the best use of your money is what is going to help the most people.
Mm-hmm.
I am a complete, for the record, complete advocate of Braille. I love Braille, and my life wouldn't be complete without Braille. However, if they have enough money for, say, a good Braille signage or a good audio, I will tell them, do the audio for several reasons. One is it affects people far beyond people who are blind, people who for any reason might not be able to read, people who simply enjoy it, and people, the, you know, 90% of blind people who do not know Braille, but who can still benefit from the audio. And I tell them, when you're trying to think about decisions, try to think about or ask us, those of us who are involved in this, generally, what will be the largest audience that can be affected by something? And then think about the other things as things continue. In terms of unique things, you know, it's amazing, even in the last 10 years, what technology is able to do, and particularly 3D printing. 3D printing can make absolutely amazing, amazing models of things. And it's no longer the case where people have to hand make things and be, you know, so as fine as the artist who made the original. So the 3D printing use, and something else that is a little bit unique. Many times I have suggested, instead of making a replica of, for example, a sculpture or a wooden object or some other object that is made of an unusual material or unusual way, get some material that is similar to that so that someone can hold that in their hand and know what the texture is of that sculpture. Or if it's a painting and they're talking about heavy brush strokes, get local artists, it could even be a local artist, including with a disability, to imitate some of these brush strokes just on a little piece of canvas. So someone will know, what's the difference between the really thickly applied, you know, paints of maybe impressionism to watercolors, to pointillism, to, you know, the finer strokes of a canvas. And that will give so much, again, without having to cost very much money of making an exact replica, but giving people that idea of what we're talking about, you know, when we're saying some of these words, and, you know, bronze that is polished versus not polished. Any number of things that people can appreciate through 3D printing and through what I call materials replica.
So talk about 3D printing for a second. Give a general overview of what 3D printing is for those of us who may not be quite as aware. And then more specifically, how that can make life easier for those trying to make life more wonderful and then for people visiting museums.
Well, 3D printing uses usually a type of hard plastic, but it's not limited to that, to make layer by layer replicas of something that is photographed or something that is laid on the 3D. And it can be anything from, for example, that Hebrew scroll. Could go back to that and say you could do a 3D printing of a Hebrew scroll, but I think it wouldn't be as much fun because with the t-shirt material, you can roll it up like a right. scroll traditionally rolls up, which is why I suggested that rather than the 3D. It can also, they can literally take all around pictures of someone's head and make a 3D sculpture life size of someone's head so lifelike that it's as good or finer than the most detailed sculpture. Now, it won't feel like the material of the sculpture, but let's say you did that, and then you also had some unpolished marble, very similar to what the sculpture was. You could have something of both of those, have this the material, and then have the 3D, and say, this is what the sculpture is, but this is what it feels like. And really have an amazing experience.
So how's business?
This is kind of a cutting edge piece of knowledge and welcoming that I think museums they know that they've been lacking for generations. They also know that they need people who have cross disability experience and caring about the arts and that creativity to work with them. It's a huge, for lack of another word, market out there. But I think that the problem, if I may say, is many people who go into the market as consultants rely on only their own or mostly their own experience from their own specific disability. Mm-hmm. And being able to either have a group, and I would like to add that I very much insist on having my other group members paid as mm-hmm. well, because they are also offering their very lived and personal and professional opinions. Now, I'm the one who puts it together and organizes it and everything, but it's very important to try to expect to be paid for your opinions and your, not just opinions, but your knowledge base. But to be very cross disability in what you're saying and what you're allowing others to learn. So it's not that many people who I feel are as qualified as people who have worked maybe in vocational rehabilitation or maybe occupational therapy with a variety of disabilities, So I would say it is really a very growing field. And I feel super honored. Again, I never thought about this. And it's funny because my daughter, who's 27 now, said, Mom, I wish you could have been doing this all your life. You just seem so happy doing this. And I said to her, I wish that too. But without my experience in vocational rehab and without my international experience and without parents who believed in me enough to take me to zoos and museums and places growing up, and without my lived experience, all of those came together. And I only feel like now, as a seasoned professional, do I really have the experience with the help of others who have different disability perspectives to really be able to talk with people and offer the best ideas. So I told
you, Elizabeth,
it all works out well.
Elizabeth, there's a fine line between education in the field and experience. Talking about personal experience, of course.
Yes.
And I think that's what you're trying to point out.
Yes. You need both.
And what I'm discovering as I'm making my occasional public speaking about my background, I made one today at the Lions Club, is it takes some experience and to sort of process what you've gone through and what you've learned and to be able to convey it in a way that makes sense to everybody.
Absolutely. and convey it in a way that makes sense. And as much as possible, draw some examples from other places that have done something that really works.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Before I turn a corner, I want to sort of, I was intrigued by Bob's comment about universal design and your comment about, you know, trying to, you know, to be cost effective and efficient by doing things that work for, you know, as many people as possible, which is what universal design is, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And that really, I think, is really important. And then there's inclusive design, which is sort of, you take those basic concepts and then try to tailor them as you can, as you said, to, you know, individuals.
Yeah.
Or smaller groups, or however you want to frame it. I think that's such an important concept. And I wish that more of us in the disability arena and in the diversity arena would take that more seriously, because I think it would help matters a lot. So I want to go back to, before we throw up for questions, and Bob, I'm trusting your acute track of time.
I am.
I want to go back to the very beginning of your business. And you made this comment about you're making a presentation about your book and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What book were you referring to, or books?
Yeah.
Because I want to talk about one of those books. I'm assuming that's one of the books. Yeah.
Yes. Well, some of the presentations I've done have been multi-sensory presentations where I've taken some poetry, both poetry I've written and others, and shared those and made some learning experiences from that. But the book that I've given the most talk on is my only, at this point, published novel called The Lyra and the Cross, Lyra.
So we talked a lot about that book a couple of years ago, and I wrote you previous that when I read that book, it was the book that I enjoyed the most in 2021. And talk about the book a little bit, you know, what the book's about. And I think it's particularly relevant as we sort of move towards the Easter season.
Yes. Well, just very quickly, the book is based on events that are recorded in the New Testament in the book of Acts. And the main characters who appear in Acts chapter 6 and chapter 7 are Stephen, or Stephanos is a Greek name, and Paul, or Saul. And the book postulates that these two gentlemen, who in the Bible are not directly indicated as friends or relatives, actually had a very close relationship before the time of Christ's crucifixion, and that Stephanos, who chose to believe that Christ was Savior, so disturbed the Jewish community and others in the community, and there were that he was set up for ultimately being stoned. But in my book, I also indicate a lot of the differences between Greco-Roman culture of that day and strictly Hebrew or Jewish culture, and some of the conflicts, some of the similarities, and how those different cultures got along or didn't get along, because we tend to read scripture, or we tend to read Greco-Roman classics, and kind of have a flat picture. But there were so many intersections and conflicts and situations where they had to kind of cross paths that I really dwelt on that in the book, with the cross-cultural relationship with those different people and cultures.
And so hence the title. Talk about the title and the cultural significance of the lyra and of course the cross.
Yeah. Lyra is what we call lyre in English, the instrument, which is a bit like a harp. And I took that as sort of the symbol of Greek culture, and the cross being the symbol of Christianity. Although in the book, the word Christian never appears. This was certainly very much the Jewish community that had never named itself Christian or considered itself anything other than Jewish. But the question was, do you believe that Jesus was the Christ, or do you not believe that?
And back then, as I remember my history, there are lots of people who were marketing themselves as the Messiah, right? I think you talk about that in your book. If not, I read.
Yes, a little bit. There were various people in great hopes because of the repression of the culture. And I'd kind of like to bring it back a little bit to what we were talking about with the museum and the arts too, because many of us with disabilities are raised as the only person who has a disability in our family or maybe in a public school or in society. And I think that having been raised and having to kind of speak the lingo of both the visually impaired community and the sighted community is a big thing that also really prepared me for both writing this book and also for talking with, you know, very high up museum administrators in a respectful but very clear and firm way to help them confirm that there may be some problems, but there are also some amazing solutions.
And that they're doing some good things already, right?
It's
start from there, right?
Absolutely.
So thinking back to your book for a second, you think about Paul or Saul as he was back then,
yes.
But you know, the reason, one of the reasons he was so effective at evangelizing is he could speak Greek and he could speak Jewish.
Yeah.
And he could, you know, he was able to converse across all those cultures. You read the letters. They're amazing.
Yes. Yes. And I would like to add, just so people know, and this is an update from last time, the Lyra and the Cross is available on, bookshare.org. So
about Bard?
No, it is not available on Bard, but it is available on Bookshare.
Well, I hope that, you know, I know you're doing 50,000 other things, but I hope you do try to get it on Bard, because I think it really is a terrific book. And
thank you.
Needs to be, you know, out there as much as can be. I think I read it off of Bookshare, you know, so I knew it was on Bookshare at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a terrific book. And thank I guess you. My question to you, I mean, you've sort of talked about this in a sort of a professional sense, you know, that you couldn't do what you're doing now without doing all the stuff that you've done, including writing that book, right? I mean, that I would imagine had at least some part in how you, you know, thought about this, you know, when you got this gig, how you thought about it.
Well, yes. And from other artists, it kind of gained their respect that I was a serious writer and, you know, that being a simply different form of art, but that I really cared about the arts enough to take the effort, take the time and write a book that was a serious book.
And not only is it a serious book, but I remember the descriptions of the scenery and of the culture and of the chaos going on in the square and all that stuff.
Yes.
Pretty riveting.
Thank you.
You know, I remember it. It was one of the things, I should reread it. But
anyway, you're listening to In Perspective, and I'm Bob Branco, and he's Peter Alchul. Our guest is Elizabeth Sammons of Arts Welcoming Everyone. She also wrote a book called The Lyra and the Cross. It's time for participation, so I'm going to ask Tricia, and by the way, Tricia, thank you again for being our host for today's program, or I should say Trish. I called you Tricia. My apologies for that, too.
That's okay.
So, Trish, do we have any hands raised right now?
Juliana, go ahead.
Okay.
Well, it's really Tony Candela. I'm at Juliana's computer.
Hi, Tony.
Sorry, that's Juliana. We say hi.
I could speak in falsetto and fool you all, but I will not do that. Two things, Elizabeth. I will write you separately about getting your book onto Bard.
Okay.
And my question is, I'm just wondering, and this is more of a personal geopolitical question than anything else. The you know, with the recent events in Israel and Gaza. Does your sensibilities about that region give you like lots of feelings about what's going on right now there?
Yes, it's a deeply painful situation for all sides. And because I do have a few personal friends who are, you know, have family and roots there, it's a very, very amazingly difficult situation. And that's probably all I want to comment on that.
Thank you. I can appreciate it.
My comment, for what it's worth, is if we really want, if there's going to be peace in that or anywhere, part of the world, it requires everybody to take a bunch of huge risks, which means there has to be some safety involved so that those risks can be taken.
Yeah.
And that's sort of counter. I mean, the whole Christian thing is counter to how we usually think, because what it's asking us to do is not revenge, And it's to forgive over. And those are complicated topics.
That's a big part of Christianity, forgiveness.
You know, and coming back, relating to the museums with that very thought, sometimes as I've spoken with administrators, they've told me these suggestions are so good, but to get this passed, the, not usually the individual artists, but the people who are, say, putting together the exhibits or doing some of these things, even the signage, because they have very specific aesthetics and very specific values for never what they perceive as compromising the exhibits themselves, can be very complicated. And that is where I can, that is probably where my limits are, is that, you know, they have to take these suggestions and they do, they are the ones who need, have to run these up the poles. So, you know, what I try to do is write them in the most universal and positive way I can, emphasize the ones that cost less money, but maybe take more thought and go from there.
And I would imagine that if the museums wanted to hire you to move, you know, to move forward after writing those valuable reports, you might be able to speak to those artists and folks who are resistant in a way that a lot of us couldn't.
Yes. And again, I want to quickly say the artists are almost never resistant. It's the people who are putting together the exhibits and thinking of aesthetics or other things. Almost any artist that I've ever spoken to has just said, absolutely, we want people, everyone, to be able to appreciate our work. And if it takes, you know, touching the canvas, we have no objection to that. But the museum might say, we put quite a bit of money into this canvas and we don't want it to be touched. So, but yeah, I agree.
So let me frame the question a little differently. I was too specific. Whoever the resistors are,
yeah,
I think you're in a place to be able to have that, to have those, that conversation in a way that many of us aren't.
I hope so. I hope so.
And, you know, of course they have to want to do it.
Yeah.
You know, and, but I think, you know, I think you're uniquely placed to do that, if that's something you know, that both parties are interested in.
Yes. Yes.
So I think I admire you. And thank you, Anthony.
Thank you, Tony. Any other hands raised at this time?
Not at the moment.
You can interrupt us when that happens. Oh, we do. Okay.
Okay. Deborah?
Hello, Deborah.
Hi. Hi. Thank you. This presentation has been really informative and I really, really enjoyed it. And I've got a really silly question. As my spelling is just terrible, how do you spell the word Lyra?
Lyra.
Oh, okay. I'll try to look for the book on Bookshare.
Okay. And you can also look at the author. But yes, The Lyra and the Cross, and it is there under Elizabeth Sammons. Good. I hope you'll enjoy it, Deborah.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to reading it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it is Lyra. I kept saying liar for so long because liar.
Jaws pronounces it liar, by the way.
Oh, does it? Yeah, yes. It would too. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a definite good read. In fact, I would, if any of you are in book groups with a sort of a Christian flavor or people don't mind sort of reading that kind of book, until I think it would be a perfect book for that kind of thing.
I would offer that if anyone is and you do read the book, I would be more than glad to join you on discussion of that book. It's a great pleasure to be able to take people back to the Greco-Roman Empire and share a little bit of the research. So that's just an open invitation if that does happen in any groups you're in.
Yeah, that's and what you're doing with art and working with museums is I think it's great to that you're doing this.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Deborah.
Thanks, Deborah. Anyone else?
Yes, and I got his name right this time. Tony, go ahead.
I am here to keep you busy, Elizabeth. Actually, I have two questions. And then I won't ask anymore because I'm hogging the time. How do you balance out all of your art and museum work with any writing projects that you might be doing? And then my other question, if you can remember it or I'll repeat it later, is how does your visual impairment intersect with dealing with some of the visual artwork that mm-hmm. I know you run across.
Mm-hmm. So your first question, you've put me on the spot, but that's quite all right. I deserve it probably. We all have 24 hours in our day, and I have not recently been doing as much work with writing and publication as I was doing prior to the beginning of Arts Welcoming Everyone. The other thing is I've been doing a number of international trips, mm-hmm. some of which have been related to the consulting I do. I feel right now at this particular point of my life that because this road has opened to me with the consulting and the other things, and it's open in such obvious ways that it's where I need to invest a lot of my professional time. Luckily with writing, it doesn't have a shelf life for right. the most part. At least the things that I write don't have a shelf life. So I have had to put a little bit of that on the back burner. Having said that, I do keep a poetry journal when things deeply move me. I absolutely sit and write down some poetry that I can, you know, look at and edit at a later point of time Excellent. And share with people. Yeah. So I definitely am not writing. I also remain active in at least one creative writing group, which I love to be able to help others, even if I'm not actively, you know, pursuing right now. Oh, goodness. The other question has left my mind.
Your visual impairment and how it intersects with the arts.
Yeah. So, well, there are many different schools of thought about audio description. And, you know, some say it's all right to add some interpretation. Some say, you know, be strictly what you see and not how you see it. I have a little bit advocated for the type of audio description that is not limited to visual audiences. To non-visual audiences. So, for example, in a strictly non-visual audio description, one might say something like, in the middle of the painting, a tall woman clad in black stands facing the viewer. One shoulder is bare while the other is covered with lace. And that's perfectly, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. What I have a little bit advocated for is what I call inclusive audio description, which would be more something like, the woman in the middle of the picture, who is facing us directly, is wearing a dress that was considered quite risque for her time. Note the lace on the left shoulder and the flesh exposed beneath, while the right shoulder is covered, almost as if it is flirting with the audience. So it's saying the same thing, but it's not assuming that you don't see. And I like that kind of audio description because it can include young people. It can include people who simply are curious about having an artistic description. You know, it can go on to talk about the brush strokes or about John Singer Sargent, you know, or these things that aren't directly related to what you see, but that make it a wider interest for everyone.
Leads more to the imagination too.
Well, that's really an interesting comment, Elizabeth, and I don't know much about audio description. But I can see the first description, the more bare bones, as it were, description, literal description, or however you want to frame it, would work well for people who, I'm talking about visual impairments for a second, who had some vision growing up and had some whatever and loses it. And all that insinuation that you bring out in the second picture, they would probably grasp. But people like me, who have been totally blind since birth, I wouldn't get it from that first description. I would have I'd get sort of the idea, but sort of the depth, I might guess at, or I might not, but having, you know, saying the escape piece and, you know, how unusual that was.
Yeah.
It would be really important to me.
And that's where either the audio describer should have an arts history background, or they should work together with someone who does have the arts background to be able to work on that. I will tell you very briefly, thanks to my friend Deborah Kendrick recently, who often listens to this show, she introduced me within the Be My Eyes app to a program called, that is in there, Be My AI, which is, you know, one of the buttons at the bottom of the screen. And it will describe any picture that you take with your phone in great detail and also allow you to ask additional questions. And if it doesn't know the answer, it will say so. But it's a really interesting form of AI audio description. And I don't, let's not go too far into that, but I would just encourage anyone who has Be My Eyes. It's a completely free app and the AI takes no volunteer time. So it's literally something that can just be played around with and used. And a shout out to my friend Deborah for having brought that to my awareness.
I'm sure Deborah will hear. Well, Deborah often listens to her, as you said. So
I've heard of Be My Eyes. It's very fascinating from what I gather.
I don't want to get into any depth except to say it Be My Eyes is an incredibly useful thing. And my wife uses the Be My AI, and there are certain things that can be incredibly valuable. That's all I'll say about it. It's not really wrong for the show.
You know, I would have to say, coming back to the museums again, is something that I honestly think is more important than almost anything else is staff training and awareness. And really, I've emphasized that starts and ends at times at the front desk. Sometimes the least well-paid or even volunteer people who are seeing every guest who comes in and trying to help them feel welcome, and the security guards and the others who are the ongoing presence, that type of staff training is so essential to make anyone feel welcome. It doesn't matter who you are.
Yeah. Okay, we do have a hand.
Go ahead.
Pam Coffey, go ahead.
Who is it?
Pam Coffey.
Pam.
Pam, you're still welcome. Muted, Pam. She's still muted. Let's give her a minute. Still muted, Pam.
We'll give you another moment, then we'll have to move on.
Right. Well, that's the only hand that's up, so.
Okay,
well, she's still muted. Oh, no, wait a minute. We got another one here. All right,
so,
Tony,
Pam, if you do get unmuted, say hi, because we'd love to hear what you have to say.
Please. Okay, I'm finally unmuted.
There you are, Pam.
That's okay. I had hit this. Zoom is zoomy today. I had hit the OK button.
Okay,
early
on. We go with your question. Yes.
Yeah. So my comment is, one of the things that really irritates me is to go to a historic house, mansion, what have you. And you can walk down the main corridor, whatever, unobstructed. But you get to the parlor, or you get to a bedroom, or you get to a whatever, and there are barricades across the door. You can't walk in. Now, I understand that to a point. They don't want fingerprints on the furniture. They don't want whatever. But they describe the furniture maybe as Victorian or something like that. Now, I have a pretty vivid imagination, but there are times I really want to know what it in fact looks like. I don't want to be guessing at everything. So,
and you know, Pam, I think that's a case where what we were talking about before, having not the exact replica, but for example, this is what a foot to a lion's claw chair is, or then that could be either with 3D printing, or this is what the carving, this is what oak feels like versus elm versus maple. That's where, or here's a quilt, here's a piece of a quilt. I think that even without having to go into the bedrooms or the places, but being able to have those as examples would really be good for everyone. Again, it not just the people who are non-visual. And I definitely understand what you're saying and agree with that.
Gotcha.
Thanks, Pam.
Thank you, Pam.
We do have another hand, area code 575-970.
Okay. We don't have a name with that phone number, so we'll just go.
Yes,
with
I'm sorry.
What's that?
Yes, I'm
Beth.
Sorry.
It's Beth. I recognize your voice, Beth. Yes.
From New Mexico. I'm thinking along those same lines as Pam. I like going to museums, but I do like the little replicas and things like that, because as some someone who has never really seen, it is nice to see what the little things look like. Like over here in New Mexico that we have the spiral staircase. Now, I don't think anything could really adequately describe that.
There can be challenges for sure. And often the larger the object, the harder it is to really give that over to your imagination, even with a replica. Yeah, it's not always easy. And you know, if you're talking about a cactus at a botanical garden, you're really not going to want to touch a cactus or even too close of a replica to a cactus. But you know, there are still many ways that we can kind of work with some of those things to at least make a concept of it grow in people's minds.
Or poison ivy.
Yes,
poison ivy.
When I went to see the botanical gardens in New York in, I don't know, it must have been like the 60s, late 60s, early 70s. Every plant there, they had a little Braille tag, and they would tell you it would say in Braille about the stuff that, hey, you really shouldn't be touching, like a cactus or something like that. Yeah, I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, that's great. The Smithsonian is one of the leaders in access for all disabilities. I lived in Washington, D.C. more than 30 years ago, and I have not been back to see updates to some of the Smithsonian museums, but I'm really interested to go there sometime and be able to do that.
So, Elizabeth, the comments I've heard from Beth and from Pam remind me of something another thing my mom would occasionally do when we visited museums. And I've heard this from other kids with parents who are also artists, and is that they would upon occasion ignore the rules and allow me to touch certain things. You know, so if they saw the security guard turn their back, she might upon occasion, very rarely, allow me to touch something that she thought would be interesting for me to touch.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sort of curious to know what your take on that is.
Yeah. Well, this is where appropriate training for security guards is really important. They do have their parameters and their rules. One suggestion in one of my museums was that security guards have a flashlight, because if they're talking with someone who may have hearing loss, if that person has their back to them, they may not even be aware that the security guard is talking to them. But having a light like that will help to alert a person with hearing loss. I think that it's not a good idea to try to break the rules, but I think it is a good idea when you go in and to either before you ever go or when you go in, to be able to talk with an administrator and say, are there things that we are able to touch or to become more close to? And very often they will say yes, and they will let the security guards know that then. And then you're not being a miscreant, you're being a guest who has some special privileges that can be incorporated. You'd be surprised how often that happens.
No, I think I'm sure you're right. I'm just thinking back to something.
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah.
So I want to, I know we're running out of time, but I want to ask you this question since Easter and all that stuff is coming up.
Yeah.
How has your spiritual life changed, if at all, from writing the book and thinking about the book? You know, as we approach Easter, what are any thoughts you want to give about any of this stuff?
Well, first of all, this time of year is a holy time for many, many people. It is right now Ramadan for our Islamic brothers and sisters in faith. We just had the vernal equinox, which is a religious holiday for other faiths. It is the end of Lent and soon to be Palm Sunday and Easter. And those who simply love nature, this is a coming into spring. I really would like to wish our listeners a very special blessing, whether it's as simple as going out and taking a walk in nature, or whether it is meditating on the majesty and power and loveliness of the power that created our universe, whom some call God, some call by other names. For me, it is certainly a truly passionate and beautiful time of transition in year. And yes, having researched it in the book, and even as I feel myself to be a bridge sometimes between the disability in the non-disability world. Those things give me strength that I know that there is hope as the season warms, at least in this northern hemisphere right now. And I want to wish all of you hope. And when you do go to museums, do everything you can to gently advocate and to discover things that you might not even know are possible right now.
I could say it any better than that. What are your plans for the future?
Well, I'm going to Europe in May through July. I will be doing a little bit of volunteering and possibly a little consulting while I'm there, but primarily to visit close friends of many, many years in different countries and my daughter in Switzerland. And then, well, I'm wrapping up a consulting project right now with a major museum, and I'm expecting with the new fiscal year, there are going to be some new things going on in my artistic and consulting life. But I guess we'll have to have another program to find out all about those.
That's right. How's your daughter in Switzerland doing? Thank you for joining us. Thank you for being part of joining us next week for an In Perspective. I can't remember who our guest is, but I'm sure it'll be fabulous. Happy Palm Sunday to those who celebrate, and may there be more peace in the world.